Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of Review Less, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it and put it on your iPod, iPad, or any mobile listening device. On December 8, 2011, Delaware amended their default standards for electronic discovery when parties can't agree on standards of their own in the meet and confer process. And Delaware has always been known as a corporation-friendly jurisdiction, so the question today is, do these new default standards for e-discovery advance that reputation, or do they just provide some certainty to parties, which helps to contain costs? We're going to delve into the default standards in some detail in this program, and we have two excellent guests to talk about the Delaware's new standards, as both were involved in creating them. First, we have Vincent Catanzaro, who's Senior Counsel, Global Discovery Manager for EI DuPont, Desmoyers and Company. In this role, Vince is responsible for counseling the company concerning how best to comply with evolving legal standards relating to discovery, guiding and supporting the legal teams in the development of e-discovery response strategies, and the use of litigation technology, coordinating, managing, and monitoring the work of the company's discovery vendors, and overseeing DuPont's Legal Discovery Excellence Center. Before assuming this role, Vince worked with various DuPont litigation groups specializing in discovery management and consulting on the development of DuPont's discovery policies and guidelines. He's a current member of the Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production, former faculty member of the Georgetown Law School Advanced E-Discovery Institute and Academy, member of the Richard Herman Technology Inn of Court, and a certified Six Sigma Green Belt. Vince recently co-authored an article for the ACC Docket magazine with another good friend of mine, Jonathan Redgrave, entitled Managing the Emerging Business and Legal Realities of Social Media in Corporate America. Our other guest, Kevin Brady, is a litigation partner at Eckerd Siemens, Sharon Malott, and the Wilmington, Delaware office. Kevin's a member of the advisory board also for the Sedona Conference, and he's also a member of the Sedona Conference Working Group on Best Practices for Electronic Document Retention and Production. He's a co-chair of the Georgetown University Law's Center's Advisory Board for Advanced E-Discovery Institute and a co-chair of Georgetown E-Discovery's Training Institute. Kevin's also an advisory board member of BNA's Digital Discovery and E-Evidence Report. He's a member of the Ad Hoc Committee for Electronic Discovery for the U.S. District Court of Delaware, a member of the Delaware Court of Chancery Rules Committee, and a member of the Delaware Superior Court Rules Committee on Electronic Discovery. Kevin's a founding member and current president of the Richard Herman Technology Inn of Court in Delaware, which is the first inn of courts to focus exclusively on technology and electronic discovery. He is frequently requested to participate as an author, speaker, and presenter in the areas such as electronic discovery, records management, ethics, and professionalism. Glad to have you both on the show. It's long overdue. It's always great to have two speakers that I've wanted to have on the show, on at the same time. So glad to have you both on board. And first of all, to Vince and then Kevin, tell us how you got started in electronic discovery.
Thank you. That's an interesting question. How I got started in electronic discovery, I think, was not an intentional choice. As a litigator coming out of law school, being a first-year associate, your job was discovery-centric. So I did a lot of paper discovery for working for a small firm, plaintiff's firm. We dealt with incoming documents, requested documents very frequently. And right in, I guess, the mid-90s, when I was just starting to practice, that's when things started to change. And information wasn't just in logbooks and in ledgers. It was in spreadsheets and in software and documents that you couldn't really put your hands on. So you had to figure out a way to look at them. You remember the first really big, you call it electronic discovery review or dealing with that type of information, basically everybody just printed emails out. So you still had to look at them in big boxes like you were accustomed to, but generally speaking, you were really looking at electronic documents. And so I've been dealing with electronic documents, from the beginning of my career, and kind of worked into it as a means to understand how information is captured and worked with these days. So it's almost you know, it's an organic way to get there, but I think a very valuable one to understand that documents are really documents and not these special magical things that that sometimes are referred to as ESI.
You know, when you're talking about the mid-90s, I was working in the Farmore litigation, which was my exposure to e-discovery, same time frame, same experiences, and we were doing single word searches in summation to then print out the records we wanted, and it was like building the pyramid.
Yep.
And I was one of the people building, lifting the heavy rock, so it was horrible. We've gotten a lot better since then, although there's more data. Kevin, how about yourself?
My background was actually in the 1999-2000 time period when I was at Skadden in the Mass Torts Group. Skadden represented Compaq Computers in some state and federal class action litigation in Beaumont, Texas, involving claims of defective chips in floppy disk controllers. And I spent months and months and months in Houston working with technology people to gather information and data, both in electronic and paper format. And we had some very interesting motion practice involving that type of information. And by the way, this was the same litigation that involved Philip Adams, who he was involved in that litigation, and he was the one who later filed the lawsuit in Utah in 2005 against several computer companies claiming infringement of patented technology aimed at fixing the alleged defects in certain floppy disk controllers. Adams claimed that the computer companies destroyed relevant information from the 1999 to 2002 time period and was seeking sanctions. And if you, as you recall, that was the decision where because of the electronic information and paper records no longer existed, but there was argument that the computer companies had a duty to keep that information and duty to preserve was triggered 5 years or so before the 2005 technology, 2005 litigation actually got started. So interesting case.
Podcast with Ralph Lozier where we touched upon that case. Yeah, that was a big case. Let's talk about the Delaware e-discovery standard. And Vince, there have been some nice articles about the broad committee that was put together. And can you tell us a little bit how that committee and how the people that were picked to be on the on that committee created the e-discovery standard?
Sure. I can tell you a little bit about you know, myself and some of the people on there, but I think Kevin probably has more of the background on the legacy. Kevin was on the original committee to draft the original default standard, you know, way before the federal rule change happened. So Kevin can give you that background. I think I was brought on as well as a colleague of mine from AstraZeneca, or a few colleagues of mine locally, to bring a corporate perspective that I think wasn't there in the original drafting. You know, Delaware lawyers are very cognizant of the fact that this is a jurisdiction that has a lot of corporations as clients and litigants in their courts, and they understand that we've put some time and effort into understanding this subject matter. And so we were both invited to bring that perspective in there. And I think, again, you look at the makeup of the committee, it's definitely experts, but experts who are practitioners. I mean, there's not a lot of theory going on in the people who sat on this committee.
Yeah, and Kevin, if you want to add to that, and you can also talk a little bit about the change from the last standard to this one. As you recall the emails we sent back and forth after spending 2 hours preparing for the show and writing questions, I printed off a lot of material on Delaware, and I began reading this document that looked nothing like the document I prepared questions on, and thought, I've just wasted 2 hours of my life. And then come to find out that was the original standard, and my family heard me yell a bit as I was reading this, thinking I've just wasted 2 hours. But you know, it was the original standard, and so you know, if you want to add to Vince's answer, and also talk a little bit about the transition.
Sure. The original committee started back in 2003. It was created by then Chief Judge Robinson, and it was driven in part by problems she was seeing in some patent litigation. So She had some ideas, and there were some experienced practitioners from in Delaware and across the country who were involved in putting that together. Then later in 2007, spring 2007, it was revised, driven in part by the changes to the federal rules in December 2006. And then the latest iteration, again, it's sort of an ongoing process. So this committee that we have hasn't been released, and I'm sure we'll be back to look at some other issues as they come up.
Yeah, I think I have a question later on that might address one of those. But at the beginning of the show, I mentioned Delaware's reputation as being corporate friendly, and maybe that's also part, you know, of why there's so many corporations based there. However, you also had several plaintiff lawyers on the committee. So Kevin, is Delaware getting soft, or is this an example of e-discovery lawyers understanding the cooperation proclamation? So the serious question is, this is a company-friendly type of approach, or is it just a way to create some certainty?
Well, it's really sort of it's meant to be a neutral approach. I mean, it was created in 2000, and the initial default standard was created in 2004, driven, as I said before, by the sort of high-end large cases, especially patent litigations, because those were the cases that were generating the problems. And so it's not necessarily company-friendly, but more than likely the larger cases are going to be dealing with e-discovery, more so than the smaller stakes cases in federal court, and you see some of those, and they have their own unique problems. But so the default standard doesn't really create certainty. It's really meant as a driver, an early case assessment and meet and confer process to see if the parties can agree, and if they can't, then they know what they'll get. So, you know, really looking at certainty in result, but it's much more like certainty in the process, and that's really the key.
Okay. And so Vince, is the standard mandatory, and what occurs if the standard kicks in and one side isn't happy?
Well, the standard is mandatory only in the context of the parties not agreeing to something else. And that's the basis, at least the basis I got from Judge Robinson's directive to us, was discovery works best when the parties agree to the terms. And judges would rather not have to deal with conflict over discovery, because that wastes their time, and it wastes time and money from the litigation process. And so the default standard is a path that you take in the event that the parties don't agree. So to the extent that it's mandatory in that respect, yes, here is where you will end up if you can't work things out. If you can work things out, and that's preferable by the judges, then by all means go ahead and do so. But be aware that this document really tells you, as a lawyer in Delaware's court, that what the judges are expecting, and tells you what they think at the bare minimum should be done as far as cooperation and knowledge of your subject matter here when you're before them in that court.
That's interesting. It really is federalism at play here. I did a show earlier in the year with Arianna Tadler and Moriana Grossman on how New York is approaching it with a unified document where the parties lay out where they're having disagreements on how they put their process together. Interesting. No one right answer. I guess we'll just sort of figure it out from the different states' experiments. So Kevin, you talked a little bit about the goals of the new standard already. But is it significant that Section 1A of the new standards, of the default standards, about cooperation, and Section 1B is about proportionality?
Well, it is. I mean, those two concepts are very important. When the default standard was originally created, it was meant as a guide to parties and counsel in cases before then Chief Judge Robinson and some of the other judges on the court, in terms of issues to be addressed and negotiated. So, and the 2011 version is really a continuation of that review process in terms of seeing what the problems are and how the default standard could be modified to try and give some more guidance. And so cooperation and proportionality are concepts that were built in. They they are in the federal rules and have been part of the Delaware practice. You know, you still look, and Rule 1 is there that the rules have to be administered to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of an action. And it's somewhat entertaining to see those words, but it is a reminder that just and speedy should be part of the process. And because of the influence and changes in technology in the business world, discovery of ESI has become a very unique problem for everyone involved. And so the committee, you know, is acting as advisors of the court to give input so that the end result is, it's really, the goal is self-help. The court's created an incentive for the parties and their counsel to address these issues. So, you know, cooperation and proportionality being two key concepts of that. And I would imagine that given the significant docket that the federal district court judges in Delaware have, they don't want to be dealing with discovery disputes in this area. And so it's really driving the parties and the lawyers to cooperate and to negotiate some result that they're happy with.
Okay. Now we're going to sort of continue walking through the document itself. And preservation and archiving processes are described in Section 1C and seem to allow for parties to continue their ordinary backup procedures. Vince, is there anything worth talking about here? And in particular, was there any debate on some of the categories of information in Schedule A between the committee?
There was debate. there was dialogue. There was debate. There was name calling. No, I won't go that far. But yeah, just to get to a list, as you can imagine, that tries to at least identify some areas of commonality. And so what we're looking at here is common sense. So preservation that doesn't need to happen of, you know, disaster, backup, archive data, where that information is already found in a live, active environment that you're preserving as the best source of that information is a logical thing. And I was very happy to see the judges were willing to embrace this concept. They understand that there are things that happen on a machine, on servers, in the cloud now that really don't have any impact on the content of the document, but it may have you know, various instances of information that are there for the proper functioning of a machine rather than the storage of data. And so if you can show, so the presumption would be that that type of backup isn't that type of backup backed up information isn't necessarily the best source to produce in a discovery exercise. However, there's always an out for a lot of these that if there's showing of good cause by the parties that, hey, you know what, we think that either the data is either corrupt or that there might be fraud implications in a particular situation, we want to go to those backups. We want to go to archived information. Then the judges will be willing to listen to that. So the preservation is for the bulk of cases, for the common sense approach to, look, the parties are under an obligation to present the information that the judges are expecting, and they're not going to fool around with things. And so the backup, the disaster stuff, doesn't have to be preserved. But in the event that there is issues that point to those systems, that the courts will allow that preservation.
Well, even if there was name-calling, it looks like you made more progress than the federal initiative to try to come to some commonality on preservation. So kudos to your committee. Kevin, Section 1D deals with privilege, and I thought it pretty progressive that privilege logs includes an explicit mention that the parties can talk about the categorization of information that may be deemed privileged, or the, you know, it's been referred to as the red-gray fatiola bucketing approach. At least Jonathan refers to it that way. The privilege analysis, and removing, you know, buckets of information from the burdensome privilege log requirements. So if you want to talk a little bit about that section.
Sure. And if I could follow up on the point that Vince just made in terms of you looking at the schedule and identifying certain types of data, again, this is driven by cooperation and proportionality, trying to get the parties to engage in a discussion and look at certain things. And so this theme sort of runs through the entire default standard. And this section 1.D was an attempt to address the most expensive, time-consuming, and burdensome part of the pretrial process, dealing with privilege. It was clear in the discussions, and everybody knows in this particular area, that the old rules for designating privileged information, and in particular dealing with privilege logs, they don't work in this environment. So the court and the committee discussed what other options are available. And this section is really encouraging the parties and their lawyers to think outside the box, to be creative, in essence, in addressing this issue and figure out a way to save time and resources for the parties without bringing their problem to the court. And yes, to think about issues raised, well, I'll refer to it as Judge Facciola in the Jonathan Redgrave article, as examples of what can be done to address this issue. And I think this is an area that's going to get a lot of attention going forward because it is so expensive, and you're now getting privilege logs that are thousands of pages long, and it's just there's a great deal of confusion in this area, and you saw that if you look at some of the other recent pilot programs and rules in other jurisdictions, attempts to try and give some direction as to what should happen in the area of privilege logs.
Okay, and like with any of these sections, Vince, if you have anything else you wanted to add, you can add, or we can go into section two.
I just wanted to point out the explicit incorporation, or at least reference, to Federal Rule 502, and suggesting that inadvertent production is inadvertent, and so the party should work to address that again ahead of time, and in the interim, that should an inadvertent production occur due to the speed of things getting out the door, that the parties will continue to cooperate and return information that that is timely identified as privileged and inadvertently produced. So we just wanted to make sure that language was in there, that that again the judges want this to work as a smooth cooperation effort between the parties, and this is one of those issues that can be very contentious and can be very time consuming in obviously briefing and motion and discussion about a particular document that went out the door without anyone really intending it to do so. So I think that's an important piece to put it to note about the privilege section.
Yeah, I agree with Vince. This is somewhat surprising that the changes to the federal rules have been around now for 5 years, and rule the federal changes to 502 have been around less than that, but it's still something that doesn't come up on a regular basis, and so it's somewhat surprising because it is a very helpful tool to have a 502 order, and so this really just teased that issue up again.
Yeah, I did a really interesting podcast with Judge Grimm on this last year, sort of to help him distill down that lengthy law review article he wrote in University of Richmond, largely out of frustration that the legal community wasn't grabbing this really helpful tool.
Right.
And I have always said it's a marketing issue more than anything. It's not that the rules don't help, it's that people aren't aware of them, and we came with some creative ideas to market it, and I'll share them with you offline.
Well, it really is an issue, and this is federal courts where there is 502. If you go to state courts, a lot of them don't have very few have the corresponding equivalent of a state rule, so it's even a bigger problem.
Well, Section 2, Kevin, deals with the initial discovery conference, and there's a description here of the 26F conference. Is there anything important here? Under my reading, it's more of a roadmap.
Yeah, that's really what's driving this particular section about Rule 26F conference. It's in the meet and confer process. I mean, it is it is a very important area, and it got a lot of discussion because while the 26F conference has been part of the rules for some time, there really needs to be a change as to how the parties in their council approach this. The what we're seeing, not necessarily in Delaware exclusively, but around the country, is more the sort of old standard referred to as drive-by, meet and confer, spending very little time, and that's really not working. And so the early case assessment, the significant dedication to resources to engage in a meet and confer, that's really what's going to save the day, and yet people overlook that a lot. And you can look to some of the other rules in the pilot programs to see that really the Rule 26F conference has been highlighted as the most significant part of the discovery, getting things started on the right foot.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with that more, especially as we now, look at, some of these newer search approaches. You know, it's a little easier to agree on a keyword and move on, and it's not that easy. But when you want to try to figure out how you're going to validate using technology, if you don't have a robust ongoing meet and confer process, I don't know how you do it.
Yeah, and Carl, you make a good point in that it's not a meet and confer. It's an iterative process that goes on through a number of different stages, as opposed to, okay, well, let's see what we can agree on a 5-minute phone call and then we're good.
Yep.
And Carl, I'm sorry, we also wanted to add to what the judge's expectations are of what that conversation is going to look like. And what you're going to be discussing. So there's, a little I to V talks about the types of information to be talking about at that 26F, and so you're on notice. A lot of the committee meetings that we had were more support group meetings in where we were talking about, well, what's wrong with the system or what can be improved? And a lot of the discussion about these conferences was that very often they end up being nothing more than a showpiece where you show up, say, yeah, we're gonna agree to produce documents, yep, and we're going to accept them, and here's our dates, and we're going to go to the judge and say we had a 26F. And then the motions come out, and once the documents start coming out, and there was a lost opportunity there. So we really wanted, and with the judges, wanted to lay out that there's an expectation of understanding and knowledge from the earliest moments in discovery. So from the earliest time that you have an opportunity to meet with your other side, you need to know certain things. You need to know what your issues and your defenses are going to be. You need to know where the information to support those is located and how you intend to go retrieve that information. We had thought at one point to possibly make this even more scripted as to what particular information would need to be brought to a 26F. So not just not just topics, but actual detail of that information. So that kind of came out of it, but that was the extent of some of our conversations at that point.
So Vince, the next section, Section 3, deals with initial disclosure. Within 30 days of the Rule 16 conference, each party has to disclose some information, and in addition to listing 10 custodians most likely to have relevant ESI. And my question, Vince, is does having the rank who's most likely to have information from a top 10 list based solely on volume of ESI, or is it who most likely has the most relevant information? The point I'm making is if you look at email threading tools, you'll sometimes see people that have a lot of seemingly relevant information, but they're just forwarding mass emails. So is this like a hornet's nest of trying to rank the top 10? Or
I wouldn't call it it comes out as a ranking. You have to tell find your 10 most relevant people, but it is really relevancy. It's not necessarily volume. At least I wouldn't define it as that. We'll use patent litigation as kind of the context, but that's where a lot of this was focused on. So in a patent case, your inventor, the technical people who worked with that person, the registration and the patent filing people. Those people are intimately involved in the patent at issue, at the issues at the core of the case. They may not have a lot of email. You know, if it's a scientist who's a lead scientist, that person may not be writing very much, but they might have everything in a lab notebook. And so in theory, you could have, you know, a lab assistant or something like that who does a lot of the communication. They would, by volume, have more information, but they might not be of the top 10 people with relevant information. So the ranking, I believe, would be more on the lines of relevancy and not just from volume. Although volume could help. I mean, volume, you know, when you use that type of analysis, looking at threading and looking at the tools, it does help you to open up and develop your custodian list and to find out who has relevant information. But from the context of defining who are your top 10, it's really who are at the core of the issues in the case.
Okay. And, Kevin, this section also talks about non-custodial data sources, and the parties have to reveal them and rank them as well for most at least likely to have sources of ESI. And if you could help give some examples of this, because the definition of non-custodial in footnote 2 seems technical.
Sure. It's important to note that the default standard uses the term custodians and not key players. And if you remember back to the Zubile cases, Judge Shindlin talked about key players. So it's still important to identify for your own discovery plan who the key players are, but the default standard is focused on the custodians, and as Vince mentioned, in terms of relevancy. The process starts with identifying the key players and their assistants, and then trying to determine the key custodians and their assistants for that information. Once you get beyond the sort of key custodians category, you're into an area that's as described in the default standard as non-custodial. This is where the parties are required to look at data and prioritize it, but it's data that doesn't necessarily lend itself to an individual custodian. For example, a financial database such as Seroquel, or a sales database, or possibly your information in the possession of a third party like the cloud, if that's being utilized. So you're really beyond the key player, key custodian, into more of the generalized repository of information and where that information might be. So that's really what's driving the non-custodial data sources.
Okay. And is there anything else in Section 3, Kevin, worth talking about?
Well, the other part that I wanted to mention is this: the addition of the reference to privacy protection. And the production of information that's subject to privacy protection. Cloud computing and data really can be stored anywhere now, and in a company, I use Vince as an example with DuPont. I mean, that global companies could have information anywhere. If you put information in the cloud, it could move anywhere. So, and what we're seeing in Delaware, in both the state and federal courts, is it's becoming a global practice. So we're dealing with companies that have information all over the world, and some countries have significant restrictions on what you can do with the data that resides in that company, a country. So this is really a reminder to address that issue early on, again, to avoid problems down the road and to avoid being penalized. So that privacy component is also a significant point to look at in that area.
Vince, we talked about patent litigation being sort of the what pushed this entire process to start, and there's actually a special section for patent litigation in this document, Section 4. Does this try to borrow from D.C. Circuit's model order by putting the issues in front of each party up front before substantial discovery costs are incurred?
I don't know if it borrows from the D.C. model, but it does borrow from practice here in Delaware. And so, I distinctly remember a meeting with the judges where there was a discussion with those attorneys who are in front of those judges every day saying, hey, you know what, we already have this understanding within a patent case. Why not just put it in here specifically? And so Judge Robinson was the biggest proponent of adding this specific information. And, you know, as Kevin mentioned, this is what drove it from the get-go, and that's what a fair amount or the bulk of the litigation in these courts refers to. So why not point to patent litigation specifically if there are specific issues involved? And so you see things like, operation manuals and product literature and schematics. That are things that, you know, these practitioners that do patent litigation in federal court in Delaware deal with every day, and they can often be the subject of very contentious motion practice and things that would divert from the real litigation of the case, and obviously add time and cost to this. So the judge was very willing to include this information, and I think it really helps to focus this for this area that was of interest here in Delaware.
Now let's talk about some of the meatier specific provisions in the default standard, which are found in Section 5 entitled Specific E-Discovery Issues. No on-site inspection of electronic media unless you demonstrate a specific need and good cause. Kevin, what was the thought behind this?
Well, this was an attempt to bring some clarity to an area that can be confusing or certainly misunderstood. If you look at the law with respect to inspections under the federal rules, that hasn't changed just because the information is now digital, and yet many times, many parties and their counsel seem to think that they can simply demand that the other side let them come in and look around at how they maintain their data as a matter of course. And that can be very disruptive, and the court is very much aware of that. So what was happening here was that the committee was just making it clear that unless you have a real good reason, you're not going to be able to go into an opposing party's offices and take a twirl through their data. It really sort of is a throwback to the paper world, and you wouldn't get to go into someone's office and look through all of their files just because you thought, well, maybe there's some more information there. You really have to show good cause. So it's meant to put some restrictions on this and to take an area that in many instances people were using for leverage in the litigation and take that out of play. So that's really what was behind that.
Okay. Next section, Vince, Section 5B deals with my favorite area that I work in, which is search methodology, and puts the search burden on the producing party to reveal their culling search terms. And the responding party then only gets 10 additional search terms. The terms also must be focused. So what's the thought process behind this?
Well, this was an attempt to, again, put some parameters out there that the practitioners know what the judge's expectations are. When we originally put a section in here about search methodology, we thought about being search agnostic. In other words, just putting language in there that said any search methodology needs to be identified. And I think the language in there does do that. But there was a need, I think, perceived that from a search term concept, that there needed to be some limits on what people were doing. Just from practice, many of us can talk about the delay and the back and forth about adding words or modifying words and ending up with a 100-page document of just the search terms that you're looking for, which in the end of the day is basically just going to return to you all the documents that were in the set in the first place. And so that doesn't seem to be very, very fruitful. And so the point of adding, just disclosure, again, Delaware judges expect Delaware practitioners to be reasonable about what they're doing. And so the term should be reasonable. And then you're allowed to add an additional 10 if you think that there's something missing. But for the most part, the judges will look to the parties to be reasonable with each other. And the folk being focused, again, defines what the judge's expectations are. You can't be demanding, if you ask me, you can't ask for the word DuPont. It just won't make sense.
I actually like that approach of putting the initial burden on the party going through their own data, because they sort of know what they have, it's harder for another side to not see the data and then to come up with the terms that are the best terms.
This was an area that got a lot of discussion, and as Carl, you just mentioned, I mean, it is the equivalent of playing the old game Go Fish or Battleship, where you're sort of guessing, and when you look at the responding party only gets 10 terms, you think, well, that's ridiculous, that's an arbitrary limitation. And yet really what's behind this is the drive to engage in a discussion or an analysis prior to this so that there's meaningful, when you talk about search terms, you're talking about something that's a little more meaningful than an arbitrary list. And I say, well, I have an arbitrary list of 500 terms. Now I can only take 10 from here. That's not practical. And really it's to drive the discussion so that you focus this area of in the discovery.
Carl, you mentioned something that was at the core, I think, of a lot of our basis for putting this language together, and that is discovery from a standpoint of knowledge. And instead of having the guessing game, where you propound 400 interrogatories and 600 requests for production, and in the hopes that you'll get the 5 documents that you'll need to prove your case. The discovery from the standpoint of knowledge is a more efficient, a more reasonable approach to identifying where the information is. And that's part of why this is limited in the place where it is, to encourage that efficiency, to encourage or to discourage the guessing that is predominant in a lot of discovery.
Well, when Chris Dale and Senior Master Whitaker wake up over in England, and if they listen to this show, they'll think that's the way we try to do it over here with e-disclosure. Interesting. Very progressive, I got to say. Very, very progressive. So Kevin, before someone slices this podcast and says, Carl said something great about keywords, he's changing here. My follow-up question is, how do these standards play out with the newer tools, which reduce the burdens of review, something like predictive coding or other advanced analytics, which Judge Peck just, is working in the DeSilva Moore versus Publicis Group case right now to try to get the parties to come up with a way to validate it. So it would appear that under the default standard, keyword searching is preserved, and it would be harder to implement a newer analytical tool if someone disagrees in Delaware. So just curious your thought on that.
Well, I mean, one of the things to remember is that the default standard doesn't try to stay current with technology for the most part. It'd be too difficult to try and craft a rule that would address technology given how quickly the technology changes.
Yeah.
And search terms are really very commonly used, so there's a provision in that says, if you use them, you have to tell the other side. Again, it's a default standard, but something like predictive coding would be as available in Delaware as it is in New York in Judge Peck's court if the parties were to agree that they wanted to use predictive coding, which is, I think, what happened in DeSilva Moore, that
yep.
they agreed to and they went to him to work out the protocol. And when that order shows up, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we'll see how that played out. But it's only when the parties can't agree that the default standard kicks in, and so something like search terms, which are really commonly used, that's why that was addressed in this particular in the default standard.
Okay, and if the world moves in this other direction, I'm sure this committee is a fluid committee, as I've now learned that you keep it tweaking and evolving. So we'll keep an eye on that one. Vince, another provision which got my attention right away is the 13 types of ESI which are presumed not discoverable unless the parties agree. And how did the committee determine which forms of ESI should be on this, and why did the committee sort of choose these types of ESI?
Well, as we mentioned before, we started with probably an enormous list. And whittled it down to these, and even once we once it was through subcommittee to the full committee, even then there were some areas that were taken off or modified or language modified. These were just areas that practitioners see all the time that become issues, or to the other side of that, these are areas that are often negotiated out. And so if you look at things like, let me see if I pull the list up here, number 13, data remaining from a system no longer in use that is unintelligible on the systems in use. So, that often, I think, in negotiation with the other side is identified as, hey, we can't even see what's on this thing. You know, we have a tape, or we found a tape in a desk drawer, or an IBM reader card that nobody has the machine for to read it anymore. We have no idea what it is. Is it all right? You know, we'll preserve it if you want, but we'd rather not. And that usually ends up in that type of conversation. So that's why those types of things ended up on the list. So it was both areas that are often very contentious or areas that are very frequently negotiated out. And so that just wanted to make it clear that these are the 13 areas that, at least for Delaware's default, that you don't, there's a presumption that you don't have to preserve it.
Okay. The next section, Kevin, 5C, deals with the format of production. And why TIFF or PDF and not native production? I mean, lots of parties prefer native production because there's no conversion costs and you've got the ability to search across the documents with the advanced analytics. And also Section 5D deals with native files, and it limits these to files not easily converted to image, such as Excel and Access database files.
Well, Carl, the approach to Section 5C was similar to the approach to the section dealing with search terms. And the prior versions of the default standard addressed text searchable, and this was the most common way to address the issue. And again, as a default standard, so while native format is also very popular, you still have to remember there are a number of issues with native format that some practitioners and parties struggle with, like evidentiary issues relating to the lack of a bait stamping or issues about preserving and producing the data or tracking of a chain of custody. So, again, as a default, it was thought that the TIFF or PDF is a solid way to approach this. And even today, you have to remember that when parties in sophisticated commercial disputes go to trial, they have their binders with their 20 or 30 or 40 hard copies of their exhibits, and that really hasn't changed. So, but if the parties want to agree to native production and they can manage the process, they can do that. So they're free to do that. But this is really more that because a default, you sort of want a fallback position in there.
Okay. Section 5E, which is the last section that we'll deal with from the document, it's the last section here, is deals with metadata fields. And the list gives 25 metadata fields which are required. Vince, why is this important?
Well, this is important for the receiver of the information. One of the only ways to really piece back together, so if you're producing things in a TIFF format with fields, you need to know what relationship the documents have to each other. So other than being inside a person's email system or being inside their network of linked folders and files, the only way to recreate that is by sharing this type of information. So you look at conversation indexes or time received and file names. That helps to put that back together. It also helps to develop your own database so you can review the documents that you've received from the other side to help identify, put things together, build your own case as well. You know, for the most part, you know, this is a pretty large set of metadata fields. I think these days, just technology is getting to the point where it's just easily enough to press a button or at least to make a run a script to extract this type of information. If, for example, you have a document that doesn't have a BCC, well, then you just leave that field empty. But the value of having a standard list is so that there's not a lot of you know, going back to the producing party and saying, hey, you know, you never sent us to your CCs, or we don't know what the file name of this document is. Just kind of basic information that helps put your database together, helps you identify those documents, and helps you use them in the right context.
Okay. The last question is a question I like to ask at the end of most of the shows now. Especially when I've got panels such as yourself that have been pioneers in the field, you know, what issue do you see now as we're here in you know, late February 2012? Which are the biggest issues from your perspective, and why? First, Vince, and then Kevin.
I think we've gotten to a point in e-discovery where the paranoia has kind of normalized. And hopefully I think there's been enough CLEs and enough articles out there that the general litigator understands the importance of e-discovery, both from a tactical standpoint, that's where your information is, and both from a client standpoint, this could be very expensive as far as defending or bringing a case in any jurisdiction. So I think the first stage is beyond that. I think our challenge will now be keeping up with technology and keeping up with where individuals create and store information. Email is something we can handle. We're okay with email. And when I say we, I mean the general population of lawyers who practice in this area. What I think can be a challenge, and I think what will continue to be a challenge, is the mobility of information. And I don't mean just from a device standpoint, but from a location of where that information is stored, but also the creation and the sharing of information. It's kind of ironic to me that as countries and concerns over privacy become more prevalent, people's willingness to be private tends to decline. People want to put their information out there for the world to see, and that becomes difficult from a identification and a capturing standpoint from a litigant's perspective. So I think that's, from my perspective, I think that's where our challenges will be. It's keeping up with the technology and keeping up with where information will be in the years to come.
Yeah, that's a good one. How about yourself, Kevin?
I'm going to be pretty similar to Vince. I mean, one of the things that sort of overarching theme is education and understanding the federal and state rules. People are coming to grips with that more and more, at least practitioners and parties are understanding that. But coming to grips with those rules as they apply to your particular dispute, as well as the technology and understanding very early on how they will apply in an efficient and sort of cost-effective way, is still a challenge to many parties and practitioners. As Vince mentioned, on the technology side, the location, sort of social media is the big hot button over the last couple of years, but I really think that's just getting started, so that area could change rapidly over the next few years. And so where information is created and where it's stored and how it's managed, and cloud computing issues, also very popular with some significant risks to those that will play themselves out. And as we already talked about, predictive coding is something that it's a real big hot topic now. We'll just have to see how it plays out to sort of the average case. But it'll be interesting to see how this goes, and that's one of the fascinating areas, the parts of this area of the law, is that what we're talking about today, probably we won't be talking about it as much 12 months from now. We'll be talking about something else.
Yeah, aren't you glad we didn't all pick estate planning as our area of law to work in?
Well, when I look back to 1999 and in class actions dealing with floppy disk controllers, the case took a long time. By the time it would have gone to trial, nobody would have been using floppy disk controllers. So,
yeah.
Interesting paradigm.
It is. It's exciting. I just want to thank both of you, Vince and Kevin, for joining us here at ESI Bytes as new participants. It's always a pleasure to have expert speakers such as yourself share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. And I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our shows. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes back. This is Carl Shineman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.